This is Audible.
Harper Business and Harper Audio present It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work by Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansen. Read by Eileen Stevens. First. It's crazy at work. How often have you heard someone say it's crazy at work? Maybe you've even said it yourself. For many, it's crazy at work has become their normal. But why so crazy? There are two primary reasons. One, the workday is being sliced into tiny, fleeting work moments by an onslaught of physical and virtual distractions. And two, an unhealthy obsession with growth at any cost sets towering, unrealistic expectations that stresses people out. It's no wonder people are working longer, earlier, later, on weekends, and whenever they have a spare moment. People can't get work done at work anymore. That turns life into work's leftovers, the doggy bag. What's worse is that long hours, excessive busyness, and lack of sleep have become a badge of honor for many people these days. Sustained exhaustion is not a badge of honor. It's a mark of stupidity. And it's not just about organizations. Individuals, contractors, and solopreneurs are burning themselves out the very same way. You'd think with all the hours people are putting in and all the promises of new technology, the load would be lessening. It's not. It's getting heavier. But the thing is, there's not more work to be done all of a sudden. The problem is there's hardly any uninterrupted, dedicated time to do it. People are working more but getting less done. It doesn't add up. Until you account for the majority of time wasted on things that don't matter. Out of the 60, 70, 80 hours a week many are expected to pour into work, how many of those hours are really spent on the work itself? And how many are tossed away in meetings, lost to distraction, and withered away by inefficient business practices? The bulk of them. The answer isn't more hours. It's less bullshit. Less waste, not more production. And far fewer distractions. Less always-on anxiety and avoiding stress. Stress is passed down from organization to employee. From employee to employee. And then from employee to customer. Stress never stops at the edge of work either. It bleeds into life. It infects your relationships with your friends, your family, your kids. The promises keep coming. More time management hacks, more ways to communicate, and new demands keep piling up. To pay attention to more conversations in more places, to respond within minutes. Faster and faster. For what? If it's constantly crazy at work, we have two words for you. Fuck that. And two more. Enough already. It's time for companies to stop asking their employees to breathlessly chase ever higher, ever more artificial targets set by ego. It's time to give people the uninterrupted time that great work demands. It's time to stop celebrating crazy at work. For nearly 20 years, we've been working at making Basecamp a calm company, one that isn't fueled by stress, or ASAP, or rushing, or late nights, or all-nighter crunches, or impossible promises, or high turnover, or consistently missed deadlines, or projects that never seem to end. No growth at all costs, no false busyness, no ego-driven goals, no keeping up with the Joneses Corporation, no hair on fire. And yet we've been profitable every year we've been in business. We're in one of the most competitive industries in the world. In addition to tech giants, the software industry is dominated by startups backed by hundreds of millions of dollars in venture capital. We've taken zero. Where does our money come from? Customers. Call us old-fashioned. As a software company, we're supposed to be playing the hustle game in Silicon Valley, but we don't have a single employee in the Valley. In fact, our staff of 54 is spread out across about 30 different cities around the world. We put in about 40 hours a week most of the year, and just 32 in the summer. We send people on month-long sabbaticals every 3 years. We not only pay for people's vacation time, we pay for the actual vacation too. No, not 9 p.m. Wednesday night. It can wait until 9 a.m. Thursday morning. No, not Sunday. Monday. Are there occasionally stressful moments? Sure. Such is life. Is every day peachy? Of course not. We'd be lying if we said it was. But we do our best to make sure those are the exceptions. On balance, we're calm. By choice, by practice. We're intentional about it. We've made different decisions from the rest. We've designed our company differently. We're here to tell you about the choices we've made and why we've made many of them. There's a path for any company willing to make similar choices. You've got to want it. But if you do, you'll realize it's much nicer over here. You can have a calm company too. The modern workplace is sick. Chaos should not be the natural state at work. Anxiety isn't a prerequisite for progress. Sitting in meetings all day isn't required for success. These are all perversions of work, side effects of broken models and follow the lemming off the cliff worst practices. Step aside and let the suckers jump. Calm is protecting people's time and attention. Calm is about 40 hours of work a week. Calm is reasonable expectations. Calm is ample time off. Calm is smaller. Calm is a visible horizon. Calm is meetings as a last resort. Calm is asynchronous first, real-time second. Calm is more independence, less interdependence. Calm is sustainable practices for the long term. Calm is profitability. A quick bit about us. We're Jason and David. We've been running Basecamp together since 2003. Jason is CEO, David is CTO, and we're the only two C's at the company. Basecamp is both the name of our company and the name of our product. The Basecamp product is a unique cloud-based application that helps companies organize all their projects and internal communication in one place. When everything's in Basecamp, people know what they need to do. Everyone knows where everything is. It's easy to see where things stand, and nothing slips through the cracks. We've experimented a lot with how we run our business. In this book, we share what's worked for us, along with observations and realizations about what makes for a healthy, long-term, sustainable business. As with all advice, your mileage may vary. Take these ideas as inspiration for change, not as some sort of divine doctrine. Lastly, we use the word crazy in this book in the same way people use crazy to describe the crazy traffic at rush hour, the crazy weather outside, and the crazy line at the airport. When we say crazy, we're calling situations crazy, not people. With that, let's get started. Your company is a product. It begins with this idea. Your company is a product. Yes, the things you make are products or services, but your company is the thing that makes those things. That's why your company should be your best product. Everything in this book revolves around that idea that, like product development, progress is achieved through iteration. If you want to make a product better, you have to keep tweaking, revising, and iterating. The same thing is true with the company. But when it comes to companies, many stand still. They might change what they make, but how they make it stays the same. They choose a way to work once and stick with it. Whatever workplace fad is hot when they get started becomes ingrained and permanent. Policies set in cement. Companies get stuck with themselves. But when you think of the company as a product, you ask different questions. Do people who work here know how to use the company? Is it simple? Complex? Is it obvious how it works? What's fast about it? What's slow about it? Are there bugs? What's broken that we can fix quick and what's going to take a long time? A company is like software. It has to be usable. It has to be useful. And it probably also has bugs. Places where the company crashes because of bad organizational design or cultural oversights. When you start thinking about your company as a product, all sorts of new possibilities for improvement emerge. When you realize the way you work is malleable, you can start molding something new, something better. We work on projects for 6 weeks at a time. Then we take 2 weeks off from scheduled work to roam and decompress. We didn't simply theorize that would be the best way to work. We started by working on things for as long as they took. Then we saw how projects never seem to end. So we started time boxing at 3 months. We found that was still too long. So we tried even shorter times. And we ended up here, in 6 week cycles. We iterated our way to what works for us. We talk all about this in the book. We didn't just assume asynchronous communication is better than real-time communication most of the time. We figured it out after overusing chat tools for years. We discovered how the distractions went up and the work went down. So we figured out a better way to communicate. We'll talk all about this in the book. We didn't launch with the benefits we have today. We worked our way towards them. We didn't realize paying for people's vacations was better than cash bonuses. We started with the latter and realized bonuses were just taken as an expected part of pay anyway. We applied that experience to other benefits. We'll talk all about this in the book. We didn't start with a calm approach to salary negotiations. We worked our way here. Setting salaries and granting raises was as stressful at Basecamp as it is at most other companies, until we iterated our way to a new method. We'll talk all about this in the book. We work on our company as hard as we work on our products. People often toss a version number at the end of software. This is iOS 10.1, 10.2, 10.5, 11, etc. We think of our company the same way. Today's Basecamp LLC is like version 50.3 of Basecamp LLC. We got here by going there, trying that, and figuring out what works best. Running a calm company is, unfortunately, not the default way to run a company these days. You have to work against your instincts for a while. You have to put toxic industry norms aside. You have to recognize that it's crazy at work isn't right. Calm is a destination, and we'll share with you how we got there and stay here. Our company is a product. We want you to think of yours as one too. Whether you own it, run it, or just work there, it takes everyone involved to make it better. Oprah Winfrey runs her media empire on just a couple hours of work each day, and otherwise luxuriates in walks with her dogs, meditation, exercises, lunches in the garden, reading in front of a fire, and nightly baths. Curb your ambition. Bury the hustle. Hustle mania has captured a monopoly on entrepreneurial inspiration. This endless stream of pump-me-up quotes about working yourself to the bone, it's time to snap out of it. Just have a look at the hashtag entrepreneur tag on Instagram. Legends are born in a valley of struggle. You don't have to be ridiculously gifted. You just have to be ridiculously committed. And your goals don't care how you feel. Yeah, it just keeps going like this until you're ready to puke. The hustle may have started as a beacon for those with little to outsmart those with a lot, but now it's just synonymous with the grind. And for everyone in that tiny minority that somehow finds what they're looking for in the grind, there are so many more who end up broken, wasted, and burned out with nothing to show. And for what? You aren't more worthy in defeat or victory because you sacrificed everything, because you kept pushing through pain and exhaustion for a bigger carrot. The human experience is so much more than 24/7 hustle to the max. it's also just bad advice. You're not very likely to find that key insight or breakthrough idea north of the 14th hour in the day. Creativity, progress, and impact does not yield to brute force. Now, this opposition mainly comes from a lens focused on the world of creative people. The writers, the programmers, the designers, the makers, the product people. There are probably manual labor domains where greater input does equal greater output, at least for a time. But you rarely hear about people working three low-end jobs out of necessity, wearing that grind with pride. It's only the pretenders, those who aren't exactly struggling for subsistence, who feel the need to brag about their immense sacrifice. Entrepreneurship doesn't have to be this epic tale of cutthroat survival. Most of the time, it's way more boring than that. Less jumping over exploding cars and wild chase scenes, more laying bricks and applying another layer of paint. So you hereby have our permission to bury the hustle, to put in a good day's work day after day, but nothing more. You can play with your kids and still be a successful entrepreneur. You can have a hobby. You can take care of yourself physically. You can read a book. You can watch a silly movie with your partner. You can take the time to cook a proper meal. You can go for a long walk. You can dare to be completely ordinary every now and then. Happy pacifists. The business world is obsessed with fighting and winning and dominating and destroying. This ethos turns business leaders into tiny Napoleons. It's not enough for them to merely put their dent in the universe. No, they have to fucking own the universe. Companies that live in such a zero-sum world don't earn market share from a competitor. They conquer the market. They don't just serve their customers, they capture them. They target customers, employ a sales force, hire headhunters to find new talent, pick their battles, and make a killing. This language of war writes awful stories. When you think of yourself as a military commander who has to eliminate the enemy, your competition, it's much easier to justify dirty tricks and anything-goes morals. And the bigger the battle, the dirtier it gets. Like they say, all's fair in love and war. Except this isn't love. And it isn't war. It's business. Sadly, it's not easy to escape the business tropes of war and conquest. Every media outlet has a template for describing rival companies as warring factions. Sex sells, wars sell, and business battles serve as financial page porn. But that paradigm just doesn't make any sense to us. We come in peace. We don't have imperial ambitions. We aren't trying to dominate an industry or a market. We wish everyone well. To get ours, we don't need to take theirs. What's our market share? Don't know. Don't care. It's irrelevant. Do we have enough customers paying us enough money to cover our costs and generate a profit? Yes. Is that number increasing every year? Yes. That's good enough for us. Doesn't matter if we're 2% of the market or 4% or 75%. What matters is that we have a healthy business with sound economics that work for us. Costs under control, profitable sales. Further, as far as market share goes, you'd need to define the market size accurately to define your share of it. As of the printing of this book, we've more than 100,000 companies that pay on a monthly basis for Basecamp, and that generates tens of millions of dollars in annual profit for us. We're pretty sure that's barely a blip of the overall market, and that's just fine with us. We're serving our customers well. And they're serving us well. That's what matters. Doubling, tripling, quadrupling our market share doesn't matter. Lots of companies are driven by comparisons in general. Not just whether they're first, second, or third in their industry, but how they stack up feature for feature with their closest competitors. Who's getting which awards? Who's raising more money? Who's getting all the press? Why are they sponsoring that conference and not us? Mark Twain nailed it. Comparison is the death of joy. We're with Mark. We don't compare. What others do has no bearing on what we're able to do, what we want to do, and what we choose to do. There's no chase at base camp, no rabbit to pursue. Just a deep satisfaction with doing our very best work is measured by our happiness and our customers' purchases. The only things we're out to destroy are outmoded ideas. The opposite of conquering the world isn't failure, it's participation. Being one of the many options in a market is a virtue that allows customers to have a real choice. If you can embrace that, then the war metaphors of business can more easily be buried, as they should be. Because at the end of the day, would you rather win an imaginary contest by throwing sand in your competitors' faces, or by simply forgetting about them and making the best damn product you know how? Our goal? No goals. Quarterly goals, yearly goals, big, hairy, audacious goals. We grew 14% last quarter, so let's aim for 25% growth this time. Let's hire our 100th employee this year. Let's get that cover story so they'll finally take us seriously. The wisdom of setting business goals, always striving for bigger and better, is so established that it seems like the only thing left to debate is whether the goals are ambitious enough. So imagine the response when we tell people that we don't do goals at all. No customer count goals, no sales goals, no retention goals, no revenue goals, no specific profitability goals, other than to be profitable. Seriously. This anti-goal mindset definitely makes Basecamp an outcast in the business world. Part of the minority, the ones who simply don't get how it works. We get how it works. We just don't care. We don't mind leaving some money on the table, and we don't need to squeeze every drop out of the lemon. Those final drops usually taste sour anyway. Are we interested in increasing profits? Yes. Revenues? Yes. Being more effective? Yes. Making our products easier, faster, and more useful? Yes. Making our customers and employees happier? Yes, absolutely. Do we love iterating and improving? Yep. Do we want to make things better? All the time. But do we want to maximize better through constantly chasing goals? No thanks. That's why we don't have goals at Basecamp. We didn't when we started, and now, nearly 20 years later, we still don't. We simply do the best work we can on a daily basis. But there was a brief moment when we changed our mind. We pinned up a big round revenue target, one of those fat 9-digit numbers. Why not? We thought. We can do it. But after chasing that goal for a while, we thought again. And the answer to why not became a very clear, because one, it's disingenuous for us to pretend we care about a number we just made up. And two, because we aren't willing to make the cultural compromises it'll take to get there. Because let's face it, goals are fake. Nearly all of them are artificial targets set for the sake of setting targets. These made-up numbers then function as a source of unnecessary stress until they're either achieved or abandoned. And when that happens, you're supposed to pick new ones and start stressing again. Nothing ever stops at the quarterly win. There are 4 quarters to a year, 40 to a decade. Every one of them has to produce, exceed, and beat expectations. Why would you do that to yourself and your business? Doing great creative work is hard enough. So is building a long-standing sustainable business with happy employees. So why impose some arbitrary number to loom over your job, salary, bonus, and kids' college fund? Plus, there's an even darker side to goal setting. Chasing goals often leads companies to compromise their morals, honesty, and integrity to reach those fake numbers. The best intentions slip when you're behind. Need to improve margins by a few points? Let's turn a blind eye to quality for a while. Need to find another $800,000 this quarter to hit that number? Let's make it harder for customers to request refunds. Ever try to cancel an account with your cell phone company? It's not an inherently complicated act. But many phone companies make it so difficult to do because they have retention goals to hit. They want to make it hard for you to cancel so it's easier for them to hit their numbers. Even we weren't immune to those pressures. In the few months that we tried reaching for the big 9-digit goal, we ended up launching several projects that at best we had misgivings about, and at worst, made us feel a little dirty. Like spending big bucks with Facebook, Twitter, and Google to juice our signups. Cutting checks like that to further the erosion of privacy and splintering of attention just made us feel icky. But we closed our eyes for a while because, hey, we were reaching for that big number. Fuck that. How about something really audacious? No targets, no goals? You can absolutely run a great business without a single goal. You don't need something fake to do something real. And if you must have a goal, how about just staying in business? Or serving your customers well? Or being a delightful place to work? Just because these goals are harder to quantify does not make them any less important. Atul Gawande, a surgeon who's written 4 best-selling books, blocks off 25% of his time for unscheduled but important tasks to avoid getting swallowed up by email and meetings. Don't change the world. The business world is suffering from ambition hyperinflation. It's no longer about simply making a great product or providing a great service. No. Now it's all about how this brand new thing changes everything. 1,000 revolutions promised all at once. Come on. Nothing encapsulates this like the infatuation with disruption. Everyone wants to be a disruptor these days. Break all the rules and several laws. Upend every existing industry. But if you label your own work as disruption, it probably isn't. Basecamp isn't changing the world. It's making it easier for companies and teams to communicate and collaborate. That's absolutely worthwhile, and it makes for a wonderful business. But we're not exactly rewriting world history. And that's okay. If you stop thinking that you must change the world, you lift a tremendous burden off yourself and the people around you. There's no longer this convenient excuse for why it has to be all work all the time. The opportunity to do another good day's work will come again tomorrow, even if you go home at a reasonable time. So it becomes much harder to justify those 9 p.m. meetings or weekend sprints. And, as an added bonus, you won't sound like a delusional bragger when you describe what you do at the next family get-together. What do I do? Oh, I work at Petemoji. We're changing the world by disrupting the pet healthcare insurance space. Right. Set out to do good work. Set out to be fair in your dealings with customers, employees, and reality. Leave a lasting impression with the people you touch and worry less, or not at all, about changing the world. Chances are you won't. And if you do, it's not going to be because you said you would. Make it up as you go. We don't do grand plans at Basecamp, not for the company, not for the product. There's no 5-year plan, no 3-year plan, no 1-year plan, nada. We didn't start the business with a plan, and we don't run the business by a plan. For nearly 20 years, we've been figuring it out as we go, a few weeks at a time. For some, that may seem short-sighted. They'd be right. We're literally looking at what's in front of us, not at everything we could possibly imagine. Short-term planning has gotten a bum rap, but we think it's undeserved. Every 6 weeks or so, we decide what we'll be working on next, and that's the only plan we have. Anything further out is considered a maybe, we'll see. When you stick with planning for the short term, you get to change your mind often, and that's a huge relief. This eliminates the pressure for perfect planning and all the stress that comes with it. We simply believe that you're better off steering the ship with 1,000 little inputs as you go, rather than a few grand sweeping movements made way ahead of time. Furthermore, long-term planning instills a false sense of security. The sooner you admit you have no idea what the world will look like in 5 years, 3 years, or even 1 year, the sooner you'll be able to move forward without the fear of making the wrong big decision years in advance. Nothing looms when you don't make predictions. Much corporate anxiety comes from the realization that the company has been doing the wrong thing, but it's too late to change direction because of the plan. We've got to see it through. Seeing a bad idea through just because at one point it sounded like a good idea is a tragic waste of energy and talent. The further away you are from something, the fuzzier it becomes. The future is a major abstraction, riddled with a million vibrating variables you can't control. The best information you'll ever have about a decision is at the moment of execution. We wait for those moments to make a call. Comfy school. The idea that you have to constantly push yourself out of your comfort zone is the kind of supposedly self-evident nonsense you'll often find in corporate manifestos. That unless you're uncomfortable with what you're doing, you're not trying hard enough, not pushing hard enough. What? Requiring discomfort or pain to make progress is faulty logic. No pain, no gain. Looks good on a poster at the gym. But work and working out aren't the same. And frankly, you don't need to hurt yourself to get healthier either. Sure, sometimes we stand at the threshold of a breakthrough, and taking the last few steps can be temporarily uncomfortable, or yes, even painful. But this is the exception, not the rule. Generally speaking, the notion of having to break out of something to reach the next level doesn't jibe with us. Oftentimes it's not breaking out, but diving in, digging deeper, staying in your rabbit hole that brings the biggest gains. Depth, not breadth, is where mastery is often found. Most of the time, if you're uncomfortable with something, it's because it isn't right. Discomfort is the human response to a questionable or bad situation, whether that's working long hours with no end in sight, exaggerating your business numbers to impress investors, or selling intimate user data to advertisers. If you get into the habit of suppressing all discomfort, you're going to lose yourself, your manners, and your morals. On the contrary, if you listen to your discomfort and back off from what's causing it, you're more likely to find the right path. We've been in that place many times over the years at Basecamp. It was the discomfort of knowing two people doing the same work at the same level were being paid differently that led us to reform how we set salaries. That's how we ended up throwing out individual negotiations and differences in pay and going with a simpler system. It was how uncomfortable it felt working for other people at companies that had taken large amounts of venture capital that kept us on the path of profitable independence at Basecamp. Being comfortable in your zone is essential to being calm. Novelist Isabel Allende has two offices, one just for writing that has no internet or telephone, and another for tackling administrative tasks. Defend your time. Eight's enough, 40's plenty. Working 40 hours a week is plenty. Plenty of time to do great work, plenty of time to be competitive, plenty of time to get the important stuff done. So that's how long we work at Basecamp. No more. Less is often fine too. During the summer, we even take Fridays off and still get plenty of good stuff done in just 32 hours. No all-nighters, no weekends, no, we're in a crunch, so we've got to pull 70 or 80 hours this week. Nope. Those 40-hour weeks are made of 8-hour days. And 8 hours is actually a long time. It takes about 8 hours to fly direct from Chicago to London. Ever been on a transatlantic flight like that? It's a long flight. You think it's almost over, but you check the time and there's still 3 hours left. Every day your workday is like flying from Chicago to London. But why does the flight feel longer than your time in the office? It's because the flight is uninterrupted, continuous time. It feels long because it is long. Your time in the office feels shorter because it's sliced up into a dozen smaller bits. Most people don't actually have 8 hours a day to work. They have a couple of hours. The rest of the day is stolen from them by meetings, conference calls, and other distractions. So while you may be at the office for 8 hours, it feels more like just a few. Now, you may think cramming all that stuff into 8-hour days and a 40-hour week would be stressful. It's not, because we don't cram. We don't rush. We don't stuff. We work at a relaxed, sustainable pace. And what doesn't get done in 40 hours by Friday at 5 picks up again Monday morning at 9. If you can't fit everything you want to do within 40 hours per week, you need to get better at picking what to do, not working longer hours. Most of what we think we have to do, we don't have to do at all. It's a choice. And often it's a poor one. When you cut out what's unnecessary, you're left with what you need. And all you need is 8 hours a day for about 5 days a week. Protectionism. Companies love to protect. They protect their brand with trademarks and lawsuits. They protect their data and trade secrets with rules, policies, and NDAs. They protect their money with budgets, CFOs, and investments. They guard so many things, but all too often they fail to protect what's both most vulnerable and most precious, their employees' time and attention. Companies spend their employees' time and attention as if there were an infinite supply of both. As if they cost nothing. Yet employees' time and attention are among the scarcest resources we have. At Basecamp, we see it as our top responsibility to protect our employees' time and attention. You can't expect people to do great work if they don't have a full day's attention to devote to it. Partial attention is barely attention at all. For example, we don't have status meetings at Basecamp. We all know these meetings. One person talks for a bit and shares some plans, then the next person does the same thing. They're a waste of time. Why? Well, it seems efficient to get everyone together at the same time. It isn't. It's costly, too. 8 people in a room for an hour doesn't cost 1 hour. It costs 8 hours. Instead, we ask people to write updates daily or weekly on Basecamp for others to read when they have a free moment. This saves dozens of hours a week and affords people larger blocks of uninterrupted time. Meetings tend to break time into before and after. Get rid of those meetings and people suddenly have a good stretch of time to immerse themselves in their work. Time and attention are best spent in large bills, if you will, not spare coins and small change. Enough to buy those big chunks of time to do that wonderful, thorough job you're expected to do. When you don't get that, you have to scrounge for focused time, forced to squeeze project work in between all the other non-essential yet mandated things you're expected to do every day. It's no wonder people are coming up short and are working longer hours, late nights, and weekends to make it up. Where else can they find the uninterrupted time? It's sad to think that some people crave a commute because it's the only time during the day they have to themselves. So fine. Be a protectionist, but remember to protect what matters most. The quality of an hour. There are lots of ways to slice 60 minutes. 1 times 60 equals 60. 2 times 30 equals 60. 4 times 15 equals 60. 25 plus 10 plus 5 plus 15 plus 5 equals 60. All of the above equals 60, but they're different kinds of hours entirely. The number might be the same, but the quality isn't. The quality hour we're after is 1 times 60. A fractured hour isn't really an hour. It's a mess of minutes. It's really hard to get anything meaningful done with such crummy input. A quality hour is 1 times 60, not 4 times 15. A quality day is at least 4 times 60. Not 4 times 15 times 4. It's hard to be effective with fractured hours, but it's easy to be stressed out. 25 minutes on a phone call, then 10 minutes with a colleague who taps you on the shoulder, then 5 on this thing you're supposed to be working on, before another 15 are burned on a conversation you got pulled into that really didn't require your attention. Then you're left with 5 more to do what you wanted to do. No wonder people who work like that can be short or ill-tempered. And between all those context switches and attempts at multitasking, you have to add buffer time. Time for your head to leave the last thing and get into the next thing. This is how you end up thinking, what did I actually do today? When the clock turns to 5 and you supposedly spent 8 hours at the office, you know you were there, but the hours had no weight, so they slipped away with nothing to show. Look at your hours. If they're a bunch of fractions, who or what is doing the division? Are others distracting you, or are you distracting yourself? What can you change? How many things are you working on in a given hour? One thing at a time doesn't mean one thing, then another thing, then another thing in quick succession. It means one big thing for hours at a time, or better yet, a whole day. Ask yourself, when was the last time you had 3 or even 4 completely uninterrupted hours to yourself and your work? When we recently asked a crowd of 600 people at a conference that question, barely 30 hands went up. Would yours have? Pulitzer Prize-winning author Colson Whitehead writes for just 5 hours a day and takes a year off between projects to play video games and cook. Effective is greater than productive. Everyone's talking about hacking productivity these days. There's an endless stream of methodologies and tools promising to make you more productive. But more productive at what? Productivity is for machines, not for people. There's nothing meaningful about packing some number of work units into some amount of time or squeezing more into less. Machines can work 24/7. Humans can't. When people focus on productivity, they end up focusing on being busy, filling every moment with something to do, and there's always more to do. We don't believe in busyness at Basecamp. We believe in effectiveness. How little can we do? How much can we cut out? Instead of adding to-dos, we add to-don'ts. Being productive is about occupying your time, filling your schedule to the brim, and getting as much done as you can. Being effective is about finding more of your time unoccupied and open for other things besides work. Time for leisure, time for family and friends, or time for doing absolutely nothing. Yes, it's perfectly okay to have nothing to do. Or better yet, nothing worth doing. If you've only got 3 hours of work to do on a given day, then stop. Don't fill your day with 5 more just to stay busy or feel productive. Not doing something that isn't worth doing is a wonderful way to spend your time. The outwork myth. You can't outwork the whole world. There's always going to be someone somewhere willing to work as hard as you. Someone just as hungry or hungrier. Assuming you can work harder and longer than someone else is giving yourself too much credit for your effort and not enough for theirs. Putting in 1,001 hours to someone else's 1,000 isn't going to tip the scale in your favor. What's worse is when management holds up certain people as having a great work ethic because they're always around, always available, always working. That's a terrible example of a work ethic and a great example of someone who's overworked. A great work ethic isn't about working whenever you're called upon. It's about doing what you say you're going to do, putting in a fair day's work, respecting the work, respecting the customer, respecting coworkers, not wasting time, not creating unnecessary work for other people, and not being a bottleneck. Work ethic is about being a fundamentally good person that others can count on and enjoy working with. So how do people get ahead if it's not about outworking everyone else? People make it because they're talented. They're lucky. They're in the right place at the right time. They know how to work with other people. They know how to sell an idea. They know what moves people. They can tell a story. They know which details matter and which don't. They can see the big and small pictures in every situation. And they know how to do something with an opportunity. and for so many other reasons. So get the outwork myth out of your head. Stop equating work ethic with excessive work hours. Neither is going to get you ahead or help you find calm. Work doesn't happen at work. Ask some people where they go when they really need to get something done. One answer you'll rarely hear? The office. That's right. When you really need to get work done, you rarely go into the office. Or if you must, it's early in the morning, late at night, or on the weekends. All the times when no one else is around. At that point, it's not even the office. It's just a quiet space where you won't be bothered. Way too many people simply can't get work done at work anymore. It doesn't make any sense. Companies pour gobs of money into buying or renting an office and filling it with desks, chairs, and computers. Then they arrange it all so that nobody can actually get anything done there. Modern-day offices have become interruption factories. Merely walking in the door makes you a target for anyone else's conversation, question, or irritation. When you're on the inside, you're a resource who can be pulled, interrogated, or pulled into a meeting. And another meeting about that other meeting. How can you expect anyone to get work done in an environment like that? It's become fashionable to blame distractions at work on things like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. But these things aren't the problem. Any more than old-fashioned smoke breaks were the problem 30 years ago. Were cigarettes the problem with work back then? The major distractions at work aren't from the outside. They're from the inside. The wandering manager constantly asking people how things are going. The meeting that accomplishes little but morphs into another meeting next week. The cramped quarters into which people are crammed like sardines. The ringing phones of the sales department or the loud lunchroom down the hall from your desk. These are the toxic byproducts of offices these days. Ever notice how much work you get done on a plane or a train? Or, however perversely, on vacation? Or when you hide in the basement? Or on a late Sunday afternoon when you have nothing else to do but crack open the laptop and pound some keys? It's in these moments, the moments far away from work, way outside the office, when it is the easiest to get work done. Interruption-free zones. People aren't working longer and later because there's more work to do all of a sudden. People are working longer and later because they can't get work done at work anymore. Office hours. We have all sorts of experts at Basecamp. People who can answer questions about statistics, JavaScript event handling, database tipping points, network diagnostics, and tricky copy editing. If you work here and you didn't answer, all you have to do is ping the expert. That's wonderful. And terrible. It's wonderful when the right answer unlocks insight or progress, but it's terrible when that one expert is fielding their fifth random question of the day and suddenly the day is done. The person with the question needed something and they got it. The person with the answer was doing something else and had to stop. That's rarely a fair trade. The problem comes when you make it too easy and always acceptable to pose any question as soon as it comes to mind. Most questions just aren't that pressing, but the urge to ask the expert immediately is irresistible. Now, if the sole reason they work there is to answer questions and be available for everyone else all day long, well then, okay, sounds good. But our experts have their own work to do too. You can't have both. Imagine the day of an expert who frequently gets interrupted by everyone else's questions. They may be fielding none, a handful, or a dozen questions in a single day. Who knows? What's worse, they don't know when these questions might come up. You can't plan your own day if everyone else is using it up randomly. So we borrowed an idea from academia. Office hours. All subject matter experts at Basecamp now publish office hours. For some, that means an open afternoon every Tuesday. For others, it might be 1 hour a day. It's up to each expert to decide their availability. But what if you have a question on Monday and someone's office hours aren't until Thursday? You wait. That's what you do. You work on something else until Thursday. or you figure it out for yourself before Thursday, just like you would if you had to wait to talk to your professor. This might seem inefficient at first glance, bureaucratic even, but we've seen otherwise. Office hours have been a big hit at Basecamp. It turns out that waiting is no big deal most of the time. But the time and control regained by our experts is a huge deal. Calmer days, longer stretches of uninterrupted time to get things done, and planned moments when they can enter a more professorial mode and teach, help, and share. It's something to look forward to, and also something to put behind you. It's a great fit for everyone. So keep the office door open, but only on Tuesdays from 9 to noon. Alice Waters, the chef who pioneered the slow food movement, starts her day by taking a walk or making a fire. Calendar Tetris. The shared work calendar is one of the most destructive inventions of modern times. So much orbits around it, so much hinges on it, and so much is wrong because of it. Getting on someone's schedule at Basecamp is a tedious direct negotiation, not an easy automated convenience. You have to make your case. You can't just reach into someone's calendar, find an open slot, and plant your flag. That's because no one can see anyone else's calendar at Basecamp. This flies in the face of nearly every other company we've studied. In most places, everyone can see everyone else's day. People's calendars are not only completely transparent, they are optimized to be filled in by anyone who simply feels like it. Effectively, people are encouraged to slice other people's days into little 30-minute chunks of red, green, and blue appointment blocks. Have you looked at your own calendar lately? How many things did you put there? How many things did other people put there? When you optimize people's calendars for effortless carving, you shouldn't be surprised when people's time is sliced up. Furthermore, if you make it easy for someone to invite 5 other people to a meeting, because software can find the open slot that works for everyone, then meetings with 6 people will proliferate. Taking someone's time should be a pain in the ass. Taking many people's time should be so cumbersome that most people won't even bother to try it unless it's really important. Meetings should be a last resort, especially big ones. When someone takes your time, it doesn't cost them anything, but it costs you everything. You can only do great work if you have adequate quality time to do it. So when someone takes that from you, they crush your feeling of accomplishment from a good day's work. The deep satisfaction you'd experienced from actually making progress, not just talking about it, is eliminated. If you don't own the vast majority of your own time, it's impossible to be calm. You'll always be stressed out, feeling robbed of the ability to actually do your job. It's easy to excuse this game of calendar Tetris with, "But it's just an invitation." But nobody ever declines an invitation in good conscience. No one wants to be seen as difficult or inaccessible. So they'll let the blocks drop until their day is crushed and the game is over. If you can't be bothered to schedule a meeting without software to do the work, just don't bother at all. It probably wasn't necessary in the first place. The presence prison. As a general rule, nobody at Basecamp really knows where anyone else is at any given moment. Are they working? Dunno. Are they taking a break? Dunno. Are they at lunch? Dunno. Are they picking up their kid from school? Dunno. Don't care. We don't require anyone to broadcast their whereabouts or availability at Basecamp. No butts in seats requirement for people at the office. No virtual status indicator when they're working remotely. But how do we know if someone's working if you can't see them? Same answer as the question. How do you know if someone's working if you can see them? You don't. The only way to know if work is getting done is by looking at the actual work. That's the boss's job. If they can't do that job, they should find another one. Technology has made the problem worse, too. Now it's not just the boss who wants to know where you are. It's everyone else, too. With the proliferation of chat tools invading the workplace, more and more people are being asked to broadcast their real-time status all the time. They're chained to the dot. Green for available, red for away. But when everyone knows you're available, it's an invitation to be interrupted. You might as well have a neon sign flashing, "Bother me," hanging above your head. Try being available for 3 hours, and then try being away for 3 hours. Bet you get more work done when you're marked away. What if you need something from someone and you don't know whether they're available or not? Just ask them. If they respond, then you have what you needed. If they don't, it's not because they're ignoring you. It's because they're working on something else at the moment. Respect that. Assume people are focused on their work. Are there exceptions? Of course. It might be good to know who's around in a true emergency. But 1% occasions like that shouldn't drive policy 99% of the time. So take a step toward calm and relieve people from needing to broadcast their whereabouts and status. Everyone's status should be implicit. I'm trying to do my job. Please respect my time and attention. I'll get back to you whenever. The expectation of an immediate response is the ember that ignites so many fires at work. First, someone emails you. Then if they don't hear from you in a few minutes, they text you. No answer? Next, they call you. Then they ask someone else where you are. And that someone else goes through the same steps to get your attention. All of a sudden, you're pulled away from what you're working on. And why? Is it a crisis? Okay, fine then. They're excused. But if it's not, and it almost never is, then there's no excuse. In almost every situation, the expectation of an immediate response is an unreasonable expectation. Yet with more and more real-time communication tools creeping into daily work, especially instant messaging tools and group chat, the expectation of an immediate response has become the new normal. This is not progress. The common thinking goes like this. If I can write you quickly, you can get back to me quickly, right? Technically, right. Practically, wrong. How fast you can reach someone has nothing to do with how quickly they need to get back to you. The content of the communication dictates that. Emergencies? Okay. You need me to resend that thing I sent you last week? That can wait. You need an answer to a question you can find yourself? That can wait. You need to know what time the client's coming in 3 days from now? That can wait. Almost everything can wait, and almost everything should. At Basecamp, we've tried to create a culture of eventual response rather than immediate response. One where everyone doesn't lose their shit if the answer to a non-urgent question arrives 3 hours later. One where we not only accept, but strongly encourage people not to check email or chat or instant message for long stretches of uninterrupted time. Give it a try. Say something, then get back to work. Don't expect anything. You'll get a response when the other person is free and ready to respond. And if someone doesn't get back to you quickly, it's not because they're ignoring you. It's probably because they're working. Don't you have some other work to do while you wait? Waiting it out is just fine. The sky won't fall, the company won't fold. It'll just be a calmer, cooler, more comfortable place to work. For everyone. FOMO? JOMO. FOMO, the fear of missing out. It's the affliction that drives obsessive checking of Twitter feeds, Facebook updates, Instagram stories, WhatsApp groups, and news apps. It's not uncommon for people to pick up their phone dozens of times a day when some push notification makes it buzz, because what if it was something super important? It just about never is. And it's no longer contained to social media. It's seeping into work as well. As if email wasn't bad enough at cultivating FOMO, we now have a new generation of real-time tools like chat to stoke it. Yet another thing that asks for your continuous, partial attention all day on the premise that you can't miss out. Fuck that. People should be missing out. Most people should miss out on most things most of the time. That's what we try to encourage at Basecamp. JOMO.